Hi, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Megan.
We're two moms with 8 kids between us, from little to grown.
We're in different areas of the country and in different stages of life.
But we both know that motherhood's a lot easier when real moms share tips and encouragement.
And remind you that it's really all going to be okay.
We're not experts. We're parents who've been there.
We're not perfect. We're real. Welcome to the Mom Hour.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Mom Hour. I am Sarah Powers, here as always with Megan Francis. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Sarah.
So we're here with another Friday bonus for you. It's fun for us to pop in unannounced every couple of Fridays or at least once a month, right, Megan?
Oh, yeah. Love it. And I'm very excited about today's episode because I am interviewing an awesome mom named Dani Kilgore, who you're going to get to know more during this episode. And it's really, this is kind of a tough one in some places. We should mention that this episode deals with some heavier content, including miscarriage, prematurity, and infant loss. So if that's something you're sensitive to, just be pre-warned. But, you know, on the other hand, if you're listening with kids around and you're not sure if it's a good episode for little ears, I will say there's nothing graphic in this episode. And actually, I thought Dani's attitude was so positive and just so honest that this interview might actually help normalize something that is just so much more common than we're always aware of. Dani actually talks a lot about how after she experienced her losses, other women started coming out of the woodwork to tell her their stories. And it got me thinking about how much these stories of loss just often aren't talked about or kind of glossed over. So I'm just really glad and grateful that we had the opportunity to share Dani's story. And I hope that our listeners who have been there feel seen.
Yeah. You know, Megan, I got to listen to this, but you did the interview. So I was listening as a listener and I was just so touched by kind of the way Dani sees her role moving forward as, you know, an ally and an asset to women who are going through something similar. She talks a lot about advocating for herself in the medical system, which we know is something that is hugely complicated in our country, in our society today. So I learned a lot from Dani. And you're right. She was so uplifting, even though the topic is hard. And I'll just say one more thing, too. We get requests from our listener community all the time to cover tough topics. And we want to be able to bring you stories that are really honest and true and from a perspective that we think can help not just those going through loss or hard stuff right now, but the rest of us who want to support our friends and fellow moms. So I'm really excited for everybody to hear from Dani today.
Yeah, I think it is really powerful in her story how much of an advocate she's become for pregnant and pre-pregnant and postpartum women to educate themselves and choose a supportive healthcare team and listen to their bodies. And, you know, when warranted, demand to be heard so that they can get the care they need and deserve. And we talked quite a bit about the treatment that Dani got during her pregnancy with her son, William Jr., where she was really dismissed for a long time, even when she started having symptoms of preeclampsia that went on for quite some time. And then when she dug in afterwards, she found out that women of color, and particularly African-American women, wind up with a huge disparity in the care they receive during pregnancy and birth. And then, of course, that has a huge effect on outcomes, right? So she's just got some really great wisdom to share about making sure your voice is heard.
So before we get into your conversation with Dani, Megan, we want to thank our sponsor, March of Dimes, for putting us in touch with her and for making this episode possible. We have loved working with March of Dimes because they really are front and center in getting important information into families' hands so they can have the best possible chance at a healthy pregnancy and baby.
Yes, March of Dimes really is the leader in getting information out there about things women can do to increase their chances of having a healthy full-term pregnancy and a healthy baby. And these are really simple things, actionable things like getting enough folic acid and staying up to date on your own vaccinations. They also support research, lead programs, and provide education and advocacy to empower every mom and every family by building on their long legacy of impact and innovation. For more information and more helpful tips on how to give your baby the best possible start, visit marchofdimes.org/themomhour. Again, that's marchofdimes.org/themomhour. And now here's my conversation with Dani Kilgore. Hi, Dani. Thanks so much for being on the Mom Hour.
Hi, Megan. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Of course. I'm doing great today. And it's a little early for you because you're on the Pacific. You're on Pacific time and I'm on Eastern time. So we're starting off the morning by talking about your journey to motherhood. And I'm really excited to dig in. Tell us a little bit about your family. First off, I know you've got a daughter named Harper and your husband's named William. What do you all do for a living? How old is your daughter?
Okay, well, yeah, sure. So I am a wife of 11 years. My mm-hmm. husband and I have been married for 11 years. He owns a media company. And so he does a lot of media work. So that's anywhere from social media to recording videos and editing them. Mm-hmm. He does graphic design, website design, things like that. He has a lot of clients, but his expertise is helping support faith-based organizations to make their blueprint on media in the world. So he does help them with that, especially in this time where everything is virtual. Yeah. That's what he does.
Yeah, that's convenient to be already set up to do that, right?
Right. Yeah. So he has tripled his clientele since the pandemic started.
Wow.
And all these organizations are like, how do I do this online?
Right. Right. Yeah.
So he has been like a saving grace to a lot of churches and a lot of other nonprofit organizations and things like that. And then I am a pastor of a church.
Okay.
I serve as a pastor of outreach and missions at a church here in San Rafael, California. I live in Novato, California. We're from Atlanta. We've lived in California in the Bay Area for about 2.5 years, almost 3 years. And we moved from Atlanta because I got called to be a pastor at this church. So that's what I do.
Is that mm-hmm. has that been a culture shock for you?
It is in lots of ways.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, it's pretty different, right? Yeah.
It is. It's different. It took us a minute to get used to a lot. You know, coming from the South to the West Coast was a big jump for sure. But, you know, my daughter, she's 5. Her name is Harper Avery. She, it's almost like she was born to be a Cali girl.
Okay.
She loves the Cali life. I mean, everything. She is such an outdoors kid. And living in Atlanta, you know, you don't get to spend that much time outside just because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And so, but living where we are, we have, you know, pretty temporal weather. And so she's outside all the time and she just loves it. So,
I love that.
Yeah. So she climbs trees and wants to go on walks. And mm-hmm. we just... Everyone bought hiking shoes. So we're doing flat trail hikes now.
So you're doing California. I love it.
We're trying.
Yeah.
We're trying.
Yeah. Well, so Harper is 5, mm-hmm. but your journey to motherhood started a lot before that. So, and got off to a rough mm-hmm. start. Can you share that story?
Yeah. So like I said, my husband and I have been married for 11 years. We got married in November of 2009. And shortly after we got married, I found out that February of 2010 that I was pregnant. And at that time, I was a teacher. I just started being my first year of being a teacher. My husband had just started working for a church as their media director. And so what we like to say is we had some humble salaries. Mm. And it was, you know, we lived in a one bedroom apartment at that time. And it was really shocking. You know, we were all for, you know, being, you know, the newlyweds and, you know, making it work with just our love, you know?
Yeah.
And so then I found out I was pregnant. And I was not as excited, to be very honest. I was not excited. I was like, no, we can't be pregnant now. But my husband comes from a family of 8. Mm. And so he was thrilled. Right. And so he got me on board and, you know, helped me, you know, build up faith and trust and things like that. And so we started to get really excited about it. And I, you know, went into a Babies R Us at one point and was like, oh, this is going to be great. Well, after about 6.5, maybe 7 weeks, I started spotting and went into the doctor's office and found out that I had miscarried. So it didn't completely miscarry. And so I had to have a D&C. And so that was, you know, another stage of trauma for me because I had never had this major surgery at all.
Right.
And so, you know, that was hard for us. My doctor, though, you know, quickly and very swiftly, you know, said, oh, it's okay, though. You know, this happens more often than you think. And so it was kind of like it's fine. It's natural.
Yeah.
You'll be fine. That didn't sit that well with me, but, you know, I kind and let it go. And my husband and I decided, you know, let's wait. And so we decided to use birth control and to keep us from getting pregnant again. But then around 2013, we decided we were ready to start again and to actually try. And I got pregnant and found out that I was pregnant with a son. And we were going to name him William Jr. And so we were really excited. I was still a teacher. I was also a soccer coach. And I was in my 20s. So I was really healthy. I was exercising a lot. There was no reason for me to think anything would happen with this pregnancy. And my doctor felt the same way. But around 20 weeks, I started to spot again and went into the doctor's office. The baby's heart rate was still there. He did some tests and things like that. And it came back. He couldn't find anything that was happening. And so he just said, well, just let's take it easy. Maybe stop being the soccer coach for a while, just so that we can watch it and make sure everything's okay. So I did that. Everything was fine. But then around 23 weeks, I started having these really bad headaches. And it made me feel like my head was going to explode. I would wake up dizzy. Sometimes I would have blurred vision. And I wasn't really sure what was going on. So I called the doctor again. They would tell me to lay down. They would tell me to take my blood pressure. And every time I would take it, my blood pressure would be like in the high 30s, high 40s. And I'm like, gosh, this isn't right. Hmm. And, you know, every time I would call a doctor, they just, you know, seemed to dismiss that, oh, you're fine. You'll be okay. It's not, oh, this happens all the time. It's probably drink some more water. You're probably dehydrated, things like that.
And that was probably a big jump from where you had been before.
Correct. Yeah. And so, you know, I remember my mother told me early on when I was being raised that you should pay attention to the signs your body gives you. Mm-hmm. Because your body always tells you when something's wrong, when something is misaligned. And so as a pregnant woman, I'm really paying attention to my body, because I'm not just paying attention to my health. I'm paying attention to the process and the process of the unborn child inside of me. And so I'm like telling them something is not right. And one morning I woke up and I barely could get out of bed. My head was hurting so bad. I was hot all over. I just felt horrible. And my husband's like, let's just go to the doctor's office. We're just going to go. We're just going to show up. And so we just showed up. We went there. I'm talking to the doc. My doctor was not there at the time. I was talking to them. They wouldn't, for some reason, they wanted to send me back home with a test where they were going to test the protein in my urine over a course of a few days. But I was very adamant, like, I'm not leaving until I'm seen by a doctor. I have to be seen by a doctor. They finally allowed a doctor to come back. He brought me back in his office. He asked the nurse to take my blood pressure. The nurse took my blood pressure and said, oh, she left, came back, got the doctor. The doctor took the blood pressure. He left out, came back to me and my husband and said, okay, I need you to go straight to the hospital. I need you to go straight to the hospital. I'll meet you there. Don't go back home. Don't worry about anything. Just go straight there. So we go to the hospital. He meet us there. We get checked in. About maybe 35, 40 minutes later, he walked in and he shared with us that I have preeclampsia. My blood pressure was like 156 over 107. Wow. And he was like, yes, I think you have, we believe you have preeclampsia, and you're going to have to stay in the hospital until you get to full term.
Wow.
And again, I was at 23 weeks.
That's a long time. Yeah.
That's a long time to be in a hospital. But he told me that if I wasn't careful, that preeclampsia could turn into eclampsia. Mm-hmm. And that can be fatal for both me and my child.
So, Dani, let's take a quick break here just to talk about what preeclampsia is, because I know that various pregnant women experience it to different degrees. And the symptoms I've always heard about are exactly what you're talking about. High blood pressure, mm-hmm. headache, sometimes really thirsty can be one, I think. But mm-hmm. talk about like what actually was going on in your body that was making that happen. And Was there a reason? Did they ever say, oh, this is what caused it, or it just kind of randomly happened?
Yeah. So they, you know, to this day, they no one has told me why it happened. Mm. But you know, they said that it happens, you know, it starts to happen around 20 weeks of pregnancy in a woman. Yeah. And I had never had the high blood pressure before, never had that ever. Which that was also something that they shared was that happens too. Mm. That you don't have to have ever had high blood pressure. It happens to women whose blood pressure has been normal. And that what was happening is my placenta was starting to not work. Mm. My placenta was somehow my placenta, the way ever my placenta formed, it formed in a way where it basically clocked in and wanted to clock out before its job was done.
Right. Okay. It was on strike. So yeah.
It was on strike.
Yeah.
And so at 23 weeks, I'm in the hospital and they're making sure that I am being monitored around the clock. And so I was there. I was in a high risk. I was at a high risk maternal floor. So a maternity floor. And so I was there. I had my birthday there. I missed my best friend's wedding. It was, but you know, for me, it was worth it because I was sacrificing for my son. But at 28 weeks, I was awakened out of my sleep by a nurse and she was looking at the monitors. And she was like, I'm gonna have to wake you up. I know it's late. I'm so sorry. She said, but I need to get the doctor. And so she contacted the doctor. Doctor came in. They sent me down to run some more tests to do a ultrasound. And what they discovered is that my placenta stopped working completely. Yeah.
So during this time, were you medicated or were you just kind of waiting and being monitored to hopefully to see what would happen?
So I actually don't remember if I don't know what they were doing. They didn't really talk to me in details as to what was happening during those 5 weeks I was in the hospital.
I'm sure there was a lot of beeping machines and like random things.
A lot of machines.
Yeah.
A lot
random
of machines.
Tubes. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was taking urine tests every 3 days. I can't remember how often, but I do know I was taking urine tests on a regular basis because they were trying to check the protein levels.
Yeah.
They were checking my blood levels. I was in an ultrasound once a week, just because they were trying to see the blood flow and the oxygen flow from me to my son, just to make sure. And that's when they were discovering that it was spotty.
Yeah.
For the blood flow from my placenta to him.
Yeah.
And so, they sent me down. They saw that my placenta had completely just stopped sending blood. It just stopped receiving blood, I should say, not sending blood, but receiving blood. My heart was sending the blood, but my placenta was rejecting it and sending it back. And that's what was causing the stress on my heart. And my son wasn't getting it the proper way he was supposed to. Okay. So at that time, and as a result, his heart rate had dropped significantly. To the point to where they decided that they needed to do an emergency C-section at 28 weeks.
Wow.
And so at 28 weeks, right after they did that ultrasound to discover that my placenta stopped working, they sent me back upstairs to get me prepped for a cesarean. I had a classical cesarean, which is not the traditional C-section that mothers or that they choose to do. And that means that they did a vertical incision versus the horizontal incision. And as a result, you know, that takes VBAC off the table.
Yeah.
This was not, and the other thing is this was not explained to me either.
Right.
It was just, everything was just happening. No one was informing me what was going to happen, what the decisions were going to be made. I was not a part of the care for this at all.
Yeah.
It just happened. And so they delivered my son via C-section. He was an ounce less than a pound. And he was rushed complete. I remember they showed him to me like very quickly and then rushed him off to the NICU. His lungs were extremely underdeveloped. He had to be placed on a breathing machine to keep his lungs inflated because they kept collapsing, and they wouldn't inflate and deflate the way, you know, lungs are supposed to. And so he was very, very small and very, very sick. And, you know, I was just, when I remember being in the NICU and seeing all of the different machines that was he was hooked up to, everything that it took to sustain his life. And I just remember saying, wow, it takes all of this to sustain life, which my body can do naturally.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, you don't, at that time I was like, wow, this is truly a miracle. But you know, childbirth is a miracle.
Yeah.
It is a miracle. And so I remember as weeks went on, I mean, as weeks went on, my son was actually getting stronger. I was pumping milk. I was pumping milk for him to have. And so, they were feeding him through a feeding tube. And so, he was getting stronger. He was getting bigger. At one point he was actually even taken off of the, oscillator, which is the machine that keeps his lungs inflated. He was able to be off of that. And so it seemed like we had, you know, reached a successful point.
Let's talk about that really quick, but before we go on, because I want to talk about what that was like for you. He was in the NICU for, I think you said 50 days. And you had the more difficult C-section to recover from, right? Like, and then at some point you were released. So what was that like? Like, you were going back and forth, or, I mean, how were you able to do this? Okay.
Yeah. So I was a teacher, but because I had to go into the hospital early, I took all the sick leave that I had. Some of my coworkers donated some of their sick leave to me as well. But then when he went into the NICU and they said he was going to be there for a while, you know, I stepped down from being a teacher so that I could be with him more, so I could be with him full time. And so I stopped teaching and was with him full time. And then I was driving, me and my husband were driving back and forth to the hospital. And it's interesting because we lived 45 minutes away. So we were driving a long way often. And it was a lot. You know, I was bringing milk back and forth. I was staying up there sleepless. Sometimes I would sleep there. It was, it was a around the clock experience. You know, I posted during prematurity month, I posted a post on my Instagram and I said, you know, the walls of the NICU hear more prayers than the walls of a church.
Wow.
Because you know, during this time, as I'm supporting my, you know, as I'm being there for my son, I found myself, and my husband did too, supporting other parents as well. You know, we're sitting and praying with other parents. We are comforting and supporting them. I was praying for other parents, I mean, other babies that were in there. We were praying with nurses. And so, you know, we were praying with our doctor, our son's doctor, as well. They were amazing. He had two, a male doctor and a female doctor, and they were amazing. Yeah. They really were. And so,
you had mentioned that you were of modest, financial means at the time. And my youngest daughter was in the NICU for 10 days. And I remember looking around thinking, like, some of these babies are obviously here for the long haul. They're tiny. How are these parents financially doing it? Were there resources for you? Because I feel like that would be such a burden. I mean, it would have been a huge burden on our family to continue that much longer. And there really are babies who are just in there for so long, and the commute and everything else. I'm just curious how other parents made that work.
Yeah, I don't know how they made it work. We made it work by the grace of God, because we weren't given any extra resources.
Yeah.
I do remember a social worker came around and asked if we wanted, you know, information, but for us, we were like, no, you know, we'll make it work. We have family, we have a church family, and you know, we'll make it work. Save it for someone who really needs it. So I couldn't even tell you what would have been offered.
Right.
Because we didn't pursue it.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. I'm not gonna say that. It was actually tight because again, my husband was working for a church and I was a teacher, and then I stopped working as a teacher. So you know, that it was really hard. But we, like I said, we had family and we had friends. And we had our church family that helped, you know, when they could as well. Yeah. So we would go back and forth in the NICU. And again, like I said, he had gotten stronger. It seemed like he was getting better. I had a friend whose son was born at 28 weeks. And at that time he was 16 and he was like 6 feet tall. And I was like, wow. And so she was telling me it can happen. So I had hope. I mean, she'd given me, seeing him, it was, for me, was like, okay, so it is a possibility that my son can come out of this. It's a possibility. So, you know, I just held on to the hope that things could change. And it seemed like things were going in the right direction at that time. But on October 31st, my son got pneumonia for the second time. He got pneumonia. He had gotten pneumonia once when he, you know, around the time when he first was born, and they were able to clear the infection and things like that. But then he got pneumonia a second time. And I think that second time is what, you know, I think that's what took us down a spiral towards him not being able to fight anymore. I mean, it was hard. They could never get his lungs back together again. And it was just really, really tough. And so on November 8th, so he was born September 19th, 2013, 4 days after my birthday. And then he passed away on November 8th, 2013, wow. 4 days before my husband and I's anniversary. Mm. And so... It was a interesting moment when we watched our son pass away. We were there. We were able to help the doctors. I think it was interesting because our doctor was very emotional. You know, doctors don't mostly get emotional.
Yeah.
During these things, mm-hmm. but he was extremely emotional. He could barely tell us what happened. He was turning red and you could tell he was getting choked up. And my husband went over and walked over to him to talk. And I saw my husband place his hand on our doctor's shoulder and he began to pray. And our doctor took off his glasses and was crying. And when my husband came back, he told me that our doctor was like, I just don't understand. We tried everything we could. We don't find young people like you all that come in this hospital with such hope and such courage and such, such good spirits. And he said, and we were rooting for you. We wanted this to work for you. We were trying everything we could. And I think this is, he said that for some patients, it's harder when things like this happen. It's hard when it happens in general, but for some patients, it's just even harder. And he said that you are just one of those families.
Yeah.
And the nurse was having such a hard time removing all of the different cords and things from our son. And I really believe I had an out of body experience because I started helping her. I told her, I said, I can do it. Just show me what to do. And so I did it and I'm helping. I'm pulling off leads like I'm a nurse. I'm doing everything. I'm cleaner, but I found out later that it was her first time in the NICU. It was her first I don't know what you call it, turn or whatever,
shift maybe
shift okay maybe shift in the NICU. And not only did our son pass away, but three babies had passed away that day.
Oh my gosh.
And she was like, she was on her knees trying to clean up stuff, and she was shaking. And so I helped her up and I said, "It's okay. You're okay. It's okay." And she was crying. And so, you know, and then I found myself praying with her as well. And it's interesting that at that time I am, I'm caring for people when, you know, I think I needed a little care.
Right. Right. Then, yeah.
But our family and our pastor at and his wife of our church that we were serving at the time came in, and I think that was what that we just kind of, that's when all the emotions kind of fell in.
Well, that makes sense, because you, maybe part of your coping was to be strong for the people around you, but then when he came in, you could kind of, you know, fall apart. So wow.
Yeah.
So, after this is obviously super traumatic, and you had, you know, a lot of recovering to do after that. Talk a little bit about how that looked, because obviously you decided that wasn't it for you. You were still gonna, you know, go on this path of being a mom, and how did that like play out?
Yeah. So, you know, we call this journey to parenthood a faith journey, because there's a lot of faith that had to be connected to all of this. You know, it's through prayer, through support of our family and our friends, our church family, therapy and group counseling, that I was able to find some healing in this, find some hope again in this. You know, like I said, you know, my faith in my strength, my religion is a lot of what helped me to heal. But I would, you know, I would be remiss to say that this wasn't a turning point for me. This was a really hard conversation, a hard, face to face, you know, opportunity for me to really figure out, okay, what is this, God? Like, what is happening here? This doesn't make sense. I wasn't prepared for this. You know, you try to prepare as much as you can for the death of your parents, or, you know, or your grandparents, you know, those types of things you know are going to happen one day. But when your child passed away, that's not the natural order of things.
Right.
That's not the perceived natural order of things. And so my faith had to be, was at a reckoning, because I had to figure out what was going on. But, you know, it's only by, you know, like I said, my faith and being in counseling and therapy, where I was able to find get some questions answered, find healing, find that it was okay. And then the other thing is, I started to meet women that started to tell me, oh, yeah, this happened to me. Oh, yeah, this happened to me. Yeah, I had a stillbirth. College roommates reached out to me and told me this happened to them. But they had never shared this before. No one had ever told me any of this before.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law told me that she had lost a child. No one had ever shared this before. And I started to ask why. Like, why is this such a secret? My neighbor shared with me. She didn't know why we were at the hospital for so long. And so she thought we had the baby. So she put diapers on our door. Mm. And when we saw the diapers, we took them back and we shared with her. And she told us that she had lost twins.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it's at that time I just started to dig for answers, because it didn't make sense. Because the common denominator there was that all these women that were talking to me were all African American. And that was disturbing to me.
Yeah.
Like, why are these only African American women that are saying this happened to them? And so I started to dig and I started to do work, and I found out about March of Dimes. And March of Dimes had this, you know, they had all these resources. They had this page where you could just go and type in. They would tell you all these different articles and these statistics and all these different facts. And one of the things I found out was that African American women had the highest rate in maternal death, in pregnancy, premature pregnancies, highest rate of cesareans, highest rate in babies that die in the NICU. I was like, what? Okay, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so, March of Dimes helped me to start finding out reasons, to start asking questions, and finding out that the disparities and the inequity as it pertains to access to healthcare for some, women of color. That wasn't my case, though, because I had healthcare. And so that didn't answer my question.
I am curious, though, and I don't want to interrupt you, but you did mention that during your first pregnancy, during your second pregnancy, you kept calling and you kept telling them what was wrong and you were blown off. And so I do wonder if, like, you had the healthcare, but were they doing their job for you? And that's like, were you getting written off because you're an African-American woman, because you were young? Like, there's many reasons you could have been getting blown off, but it sounds like you kind of were. And I'm sure that's a tie too, right?
Right. It is. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say, that, like you just said, that's not what was not having health care was not my issue. My issue was not being seen as a valuable and as someone who needed a certain level of care. I was being written off. I was being dismissed. And dare I say, I was being seen as like an angry Black woman who was just irate for no reason. And only to find out, oh, there really is something. Send her straight to the hospital. Right. It's like, what about if you had shared with me, if you had taken me seriously when something first was brought up, maybe this could have changed. I don't know. But, nevertheless, it was. So, I think at that point I was starting to research, get more information, find out more details. And so I was ready. I felt like I was equipped enough to try again. I had enough knowledge base to where I could ask questions. I could advocate for my own care should this happen again. And so we decided to try again in 2014, and we did, but I miscarried. I had another early miscarriage.
Oh my gosh.
And so I think at that time, my husband and I, we said, what would life look like without children? And we just started to explore that. And we started to explore, what it would be like if it was just us, or if we decided to adopt. I mean, we even started to get the information from our county for what would it look like to be a foster parent and things like that. So, I was a youth pastor at that time. And so, and a teacher. So I was already a surrogate mother to a whole lot of children. I was like, okay, well, this is, I'm fulfilling this, so it'll be fine. And so we just, at that point, said, okay, well, it'll just be us. So we took a vacation to Las Vegas, and we discovered that, the saying, everything that happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Yeah.
That's not true. Mm-mm, that's not true.
Do you bring something back with you?
We brought back a positive pregnancy.
I love it.
Yeah, we went to Las Vegas on a vacation and came back pregnant.
Wow.
And so, we weren't trying. It happened. Mm. And we were like, oh, wow. Okay. I was very anxious. I was nervous about this because of what had happened in the past.
Yeah.
But, I had the strength of my support group. I had the strength of, my church family and things like that. My husband and I, were strong together, and things were different. My doctors were different. My doctors heard me. My doctors sat us down and talked to us about the type of care. Our doctors told us the plan that they wanted to do. My doctors asked me, am I okay with this plan? Is there anything I would like to see happen? What outside of the goal of having this, of having a healthy baby, what I expect from him or as my doctor? That had not been asked of me, but he was African American. Mm. My doctor was, my nursing staff was predominantly African American. And I can't help but to think it's because the first thing he said when I walked into his office was, before anything, he said, Ms. Kilgore, I see from the chart that you've experienced some major losses throughout the years. And I want to say, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. I am so sorry that you've had to experience that. I was blown away.
Yeah.
He connected with me, not as his patient, not as chart number 2275.
Right.
But as Danielle Kilgore, a woman, a human who has experienced a loss. He connected with his heart to me first. And at that was big for me. And that did not happen with my previous doctors, who were white, to be very frank. They blew off my, oh, you have miscarriage. Oh, it's normal. I mean, he said that too. He said, I see that you've had miscarriages. And unfortunately, that happens more often than we would like to see it happen. I remember his conversation because the words he chose to use were more of, gosh, this shouldn't happen this way, but it does. It happens.
Right. Yeah. Not so blasé about it. Yeah.
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 Wow.
So, you know, I found out that we were having a girl and, you know, our high risk doctor told us, he said, I want you to know that, you know, we call them African-American little girls tend to, if she does go to the NICU, they fight harder. He said, I don't know what it is, but they tend to do way better in the NICU. And he said that, so I just wanted to kind of give you that encouragement for whatever it's worth.
Right.
And she did. You know, my daughter was born at 35 weeks, and that was by choice between us and our doctors to go ahead and deliver early because there was some signs that preeclampsia was returning again. And so we decided to deliver via classical cesarean. And we talked about that too. My doctor talked to me about the possibility. He said, if you want to do VBAC, we can try, but I want you to know the risk.
Yeah.
I want you to know what would happen. He talked to us about everything. And so, we went ahead and decided to deliver her at 35 weeks. She was born almost 4 pounds. But her lungs were fine. She was eating. She just needed to get plumped up.
Yeah.
And so we're from the South. Like I said earlier, from Atlanta. So my husband's mother was like, I just need you to eat some grits and some collard greens and some cornbread so you can fatten that breast milk.
I love it.
So she was bringing me all this food. I was like, I can't eat all this food. But she's bringing me all this food because she's like, no, we got thinking that breast milk up.
I love
so
it.
We can get fat.
Yeah. You're like, I'm not sure it works that way, but okay.
Right. Right. You know, those old Southern wives.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They think of everything. But she was doing well. The only thing that, as a result, and they told us this was one of the possibilities of her being born prematurely at that gestational age, was that she could, you know, be born blind, she could be born with a hearing loss, she could be born with digestive issues and things like that. Well, my daughter was born with sensorineural hearing loss, and so she does have she does wear bilateral hearing aids.
Okay.
Because so the threads or the fibers or nerves in her ear that causes you to hear, either they didn't properly grow or they grew and died due to her prematurity. But I mean, so she does wear hearing aids so that sound can be amplified for her. But other than that, I mean, my daughter is very healthy. She's 5. She's in kindergarten. She reads right now and she's doing well. She loves to sing. She loves to dance. Like I said, she's such an outdoors kid. She loves talking and having fun and things like that. And so,
knew going in that could happen. So I'm sure you felt so much more like you were part of that conversation and were prepared for it. Whereas it wasn't just like, oh yeah, by the way.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. We were prepared. Like they gave us all this information beforehand that all the things that could happen. And so, when I look at my daughter, she's definitely a sign of what faith, what support and what a miracle looks like for sure. Yeah. She's a blessing to us, and those doctors were a blessing to us. You know, I was previously I was at a private, when with my son, at a private care, I was at a private doctor's office. And when I was with my daughter, I was with Kaiser. And I don't know if, you know, different training is given when you're with a more of a corporate type hospital system versus private care doctor system. But that it's almost, I mean, they understood what it meant to provide equitable and equitable health practices.
Yeah.
They knew what it was like. They knew what to do. They knew how to talk. And then because I was looking, I was being cared for someone who looked like me.
Right.
It was just different.
Danny, I know we have to wrap this up in a minute, but I just wonder if women who are in the situation you found yourself in with William Jr., what do you tell them now? Like, if they don't feel like they're being heard, if they are not being listened to, if they just have a bad feeling, what do you tell them to do?
I tell them to fight.
Yeah.
You know, you deserve as much health care. You deserve to be listened to as much as anyone else. Like, this is service you're paying for. You're paying for this. And even for, you know, even for mothers that, you know, maybe on different type of insurance, where, you know, it's Medicaid or Medicare or whatever. Yeah. It doesn't matter. You know, every life matters. Every life matters. And that of the one that's talking to you, Mr. Doctor, and the one or Miss Doctor, as well as the one that's inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
They all matter. And, you know, no one should be dismissed. No one should be seen as invaluable. And so that's the first thing I would do, is to make sure that you don't give up. Don't let them tell you what you know, what you don't know. And then the other thing is to also do your own research, You know, knowledge is power. You know, scripture says that my people perish for a lack of knowledge. And so we should be educating ourselves. You know, Google is, you know, good for some things, good, not good for other things, but it's a start.
It's a place to at least figure out if what's happening is normal or worrisome or, it gets you on the path.
But there are organizations that do have, credible information, and you can go to March of Dimes. March of Dimes was where I went, that they've partnered with doctors. They've partnered with the CDC. And the CDC is a credible organization that knows all of these different things, you know. And so you can find information and you can be in the know. I mean, there are also all types of Facebook groups where women that were like me that can go on and ask questions, and mothers, exchange information. Oh, this is what I said. This is what I did. This is what worked for me or didn't work for me, you know. Being able to find community is really important. You know, you in community, you get answers. You don't have to be alone. You don't have to walk this journey alone, because it is hard. You know, this is a sorority that never stops hazing. You never forget what happened to you. I remember, I'm pretty sure, Megan, you'll never forget those 10 days that your child was in the NICU.
No, never
you,
will.
When you think about it, it's something that will never. And I think that, you know, you providing this platform and allowing mothers like me to share our stories is also something that helps too. So I thank you for that.
Thank you.
It's important. And I wish more mothers, I wish our society would, see these stories not as stories of sorrow, stories of sadness, but they would see it as stories of strength, courage, and hope. And that these are stories that need to be shared. These are stories that need to be amplified and illuminated as what they are. Women and fathers who fight for the sake of their unborn child, or sometimes for their child.
Yeah.
Or that share the stories that this didn't happen. This happened to me, but it is still possible for it to happen to you. And so, yeah.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for sharing your story. I so appreciate it. I know it's going to help a lot of moms listening. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, Megan.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. And a big thanks again to Dani for sharing about her journey.
We also want to thank the March of Dimes for sponsoring this episode and working with us all month long to raise awareness for Birth Defects Prevention Month and the hashtag Best for You, Best for Baby initiative. And that's the numeral 4. Again, we hope you'll check out their tips and resources at marchofdimes.org/themomhour. And we'll be back with you Tuesday of next week with an all new episode. Have a great weekend and we'll talk to you then.